and let's go immediately. Before going, however, I decided it was best to let her know just how I stood, so that there wouldn't be any squawking at the last minute. I thought she was going to faint when I told her how much I had in my pocket. "The likes of it," she said. Highly insulted she was. I thought there would be a scene. Undaunted, however, I stood my ground. "Very well, then. I'll leave you," I said quietly. "Perhaps I've made a mistake."
"I should say you have," she exclaimed,
but clutching me by the sleeve at the same time.
"Écoute, chérie, sois raisonnable."
When I heard that, all my confidence was restored. I knew that it would be merely a question of promising her a little extra, and everything would be okay. "All right," I said wearily. "I'll be nice to you. You'll see."
"You were lying to me then?" she said.
"Yes," I smiled. "I was just lying." Before I had even put my hat on, she had hailed a cab. I heard her give the Boulevard de Clichy for an address. That was more than the price of room, I thought to myself. Oh well, there was time yet. We'd see. I don't know how it started anymore, but soon she was raving to me about Henri Bordeaux. I have yet to meet a whore who doesn't know of Henri Bordeaux. But this one was genuinely inspired. Her language was beautiful now, so tender, so discerning, that I was debating how much to give her. It seemed to me that I heard her say, "Quand il n'y aura plus de temps." It sounded like that anyway. In the state I was in, a phrase like that was worth 100 francs. I wondered if it was her own or if she had pulled it from Henri Bordeaux. Little matter. It was just the right phrase with which to roll up to the foot of Montmartre. "Good evening, mother," I was saying to myself. "Daughter and I will look after you. Quand il n'y aura plus de temps." She was going to show me her diploma, too. I remembered that. She was all a flutter, once the door had closed behind us, distracted, wringing her hands and striking Sarah Bernhardt poses, half undressed, too, and pausing between times to urge me to hurry, to get undressed, to do this and do that. Finally, when she had stripped down and was poking about with a chemise in her hand, searching for her kimono, I caught hold of her and gave her a good squeeze. She had a look of anguish on her face when I released her.
"My God, my God, I must go downstairs and have a look at Mother," she exclaimed. "You can take a bath if you like, chérie. There, I'll be back in a few minutes."
At the door, I embraced her again. I was in my underclothes, and I had a tremendous erection. Somehow all this anguish and excitement, all the grief and histrionics only whetted my appetite. Perhaps she was just going downstairs to quiet her macro. I had a feeling that something unusual was happening, some sort of drama, which I would read about in the morning paper. I gave the place a quick inspection. There were 2 rooms and a bath, not badly furnished, rather coquettish. There was her diploma on the wall, first class, as they all read. And there was the photograph of a child, a little girl with beautiful locks, on the dresser. I put the water on for a bath, and then I changed my mind. If something were to happen and I were found in the tub, I didn't like the idea. I paced back and forth, getting more and more uneasy as the minutes rolled by. When she returned, she was even more upset than before.
"She's going to die. She's going to die," she kept wailing.
For a moment, I was almost on the point of leaving. How the hell can you climb over a woman when her mother's dying downstairs, perhaps right beneath you? I put my arms around her, half in sympathy and half determined to get what I had come for. As we stood thus, she murmured, as if in real distress, her need for the money I had promised her. It was for Mama. Shit, I didn't have the heart to haggle about a few francs at the moment. I walked over to the chair where my clothes were lying, and I wiggled 100-franc note out of my fob pocket, carefully keeping my back turned to her just the same. And as a further precaution, I placed my pants on the side of the bed where I knew I was going to flop. The 100 francs wasn't altogether satisfactory to her, but I could see from the feeble way that she protested that it was quite enough. Then, with an energy that astonished me, she flung off her kimono and jumped into bed. As soon as I had put my arms around her and pulled her to me, she reached for the switch, and out went the lights. She embraced me passionately, and she groaned as all French cunts do when they get you in bed. She was getting me frightfully roused with her carrying on. That business of turning out the lights was a new one to me. It seemed like the real thing. But I was suspicious, too, and as soon as I could manage conveniently, I put my hands out,
to feel if my trousers were still there on the chair. I thought we were settled for the night. The bed felt very comfortable, softer than the average hotel bed, and the sheets were clean. I had noticed that. If only she wouldn't squirm so. You would think she hadn't slept with a man for a month. I wanted to stretch it out. I wanted full value for my 100 francs. But she was mumbling all sorts of things in that crazy bed language which goes to your blood even more rapidly when it's in the dark. I was putting up a stiff fight, but it was impossible with her groaning and gasping going on, and her muttering, vite, chérie, oh, c'est bon, oh, oh, vite, vite, chérie. I tried to count, but it was like a fire alarm going off. Vite, chérie! And this time she gave such a gasping shudder that, bango, I heard the stars chiming, and there was my 100 francs gone, and the 50 that I had forgotten all about, and the lights were on again, and with the same alacrity that she had bounced into bed, she was bouncing out again, and grunting and squealing like an old sow. I lay back and puffed a cigarette, gazing ruefully at my pants the while. They were terribly wrinkled. In a moment she was back again, wrapping the kimono around her and telling me in that agitated way which was getting on my nerves that I should make myself at home. I'm going downstairs to see my mother, she said. Mais faites comme chez vous, chérie. Je reviens tout de suite. After a quarter of an hour had passed, I began to feel thoroughly restless. I went inside and I read through a letter that was lying on the table. It was nothing of any account, a love letter. In the bathroom, I examined all the bottles on the shelf. She had everything a woman requires to make herself smell beautiful. I was still hoping that she would come back and give me another 50 francs worth. But time dragged on and there was no sign of her. I began to grow alarmed. Perhaps there was someone dying downstairs. Absent-mindedly, out of a sense of self-preservation, I suppose, I began to put my things on. As I was buckling my belt, it came to me like a flash how she had stuffed the 100 franc note into her purse. In the excitement of the moment, she had thrust the purse in the wardrobe on the upper shelf. I remembered the gesture she made, standing on her tiptoes and reaching for the shelf. It didn't take me a minute to open the wardrobe and feel around for the purse. It was still there. I opened it hurriedly and saw my 100 franc note lying snugly between the silk coverlets. I put the purse back just as it was, slipped into my coat and shoes, and then I went to the landing and listened intently. I couldn't hear a sound. Where she had gone to, Christ only knows. In a jiffy, I was back at the wardrobe and fumbling with her purse. I pocketed the 100 francs and all the loose change besides. Then, closing the door silently, I tiptoed down the stairs, and when once I had hit the street, I walked just as fast as my legs would carry me. At the Café Boudon, I stopped for a bite, the whores there having a gay time pelting a fat man who had fallen asleep over his meal. He was sound asleep, snoring, in fact, and yet his jaws were working away mechanically. The place was in an uproar. There were shouts of, "All aboard!" and then a concerted banging of knives and forks. He opened his eyes for a moment, blinked stupidly, and then his head rolled forward again on his chest. I put the 100 franc bill carefully away in my fob pocket and counted the change. The din around me was increasing, and I had difficulty to recall exactly whether I had seen first class on her diploma or not. It bothered me. About her mother, I didn't give a damn. I hoped she had croaked by now. It would be strange if what she had said were true, too good to believe. Vite, chérie, vite, vite. And the other half-wit, with her, "My good sir, and you have such a kind face." I wondered if she had really taken a room in that hotel we stopped by. It was along the close of summer when Fillmore invited me to come and live with him. He had a studio apartment overlooking the cavalry barracks just off the Place Duplex. We had seen a lot of each other since the little trip to Le Havre. If it hadn't been for Fillmore, I don't know where I should be today. Dead, most likely. "I would have asked you long before," he said, "if it hadn't been for that little bitch, Jackie. I didn't know how to get her off my hands." I had to smile. It was always like that with Fillmore. He had a genius for attracting homeless bitches. Anyway, Jackie had finally cleared out of her own accord. The rainy season was coming on, the long, dreary stretch of grease and fog and squirts of rain that make you damp and miserable. An execrable place in the winter, Paris. a climate that eats into your soul, that leaves you bare as the Labrador coast. I noticed with some anxiety that the only means of heating the place was the little stove in the studio. However, it was still comfortable, and the view from the studio window was superb. In the morning, Fillmore would shake me roughly and leave a 10-franc note on the pillow. As soon as he had gone, I would settle back for a final snooze. Sometimes I would lie abed till noon. There was nothing pressing except to finish the book, and that didn't worry me much because I was already convinced that nobody would accept it anyway. Nevertheless, Fillmore was much impressed by it. When he arrived in the evening with a bottle under his arm, the first thing he did was to go to the table and see how many pages I had knocked off. At first I enjoyed this show of enthusiasm, but later, when I was running dry, it made me devilishly uneasy to see him poking around, searching for the pages that were supposed to trickle out of me like water from a tap. When there was nothing to show, I felt exactly like some bitch whom he had harbored. He used to say about Jackie, I remembered, "It would have been all right if only she had slipped me a piece of ass once in a while." If I had been a woman, I would have been only too glad to slip him a piece of ass. It would have been much easier than to feed him the pages, which he expected. Nevertheless, he tried to make me feel at ease. There was always plenty of food and wine, and now and then he would insist that I accompany him to a dancing. He was fond of going to a nigger joint on the Rue d'Odessa, where there was a good-looking mulatto who used to come home with us occasionally. The one thing that bothered him was that he couldn't find a French girl who liked to drink. They were all too sober to satisfy him. He liked to bring a woman back to the studio and guzzle it with her before getting down to business. He also liked to have her think that he was an artist. As the man from whom he had rented the place was a painter, it was not difficult to create an impression. The canvases which we had found in the armoire were soon stuck about the place, and one of the unfinished ones conspicuously mounted on the easel. Unfortunately, they were all of a surrealistic quality, and the impression they created was usually unfavorable. Between a whore, a concierge, and a cabinet minister, there is not much difference in taste where pictures are concerned. It was a matter of great relief to Fillmore when Mark Swift began to visit us regularly with the intention of doing my portrait. Fillmore had a great admiration for Swift. He was a genius, he said. And though there was something ferocious about everything he tackled, nevertheless, when he painted a man or an object, you could recognize it for what it was. At Swift's request, I had begun to grow a beard. The shape of my skull, he said, required a beard. I had to sit by the window with the Eiffel Tower in back of me, because he wanted the Eiffel Tower in the picture, too. He also wanted the typewriter in the picture. Kruger got the habit of dropping in, too, about this time. He maintained that Swift knew nothing about painting. It exasperated him to see things out of proportion. He believed in nature's laws implicitly. Swift didn't give a fuck about nature. He wanted to paint what was inside his head. Anyway, there was Swift's portrait of me stuck on the easel now, and though everything was out of proportion, even a cabinet minister could see that it was a human head, a man with a beard. The concierge indeed began to take a great interest in the picture. She thought the likeness was striking, and she liked the idea of showing the Eiffel Tower in the background. Things rolled along this way peacefully for about a month or more. The neighborhood appealed to me, particularly at night, when the full squalor and lugubriousness of it made itself felt. The little place, so charming and tranquil at twilight, could assume the most dismal, sinister character when darkness came on. There was that long, high wall covering one side of the barracks, against which there was always a couple embracing each other furtively, often in the rain. A depressing sight to see two lovers squeezed against a prison wall under a gloomy streetlight, as if they had been driven right to the last bounds. What went on inside the enclosure was also depressing. On a rainy day, I used to stand by the window and look down on the activity below, quite as if it were something going on another planet. It seemed incomprehensible to me. Everything done according to schedule, but a schedule that must have been devised by a lunatic. There they were, floundering around in the mud, the bugles blowing, the horses charging, all within four walls. A sham battle. A lot of tin soldiers who hadn't the least interest in learning how to kill, or how to polish their boots, or currycomb the horses.
Utterly ridiculous, the whole thing, but part of the scheme of things. When they had nothing to do, they looked even more ridiculous. They scratched themselves. They walked about with their hands in their pockets. They looked up at the sky. And when an officer came along, they clicked their heels and saluted. A madhouse, it seemed to me. Even the horses looked silly. And then sometimes the artillery was dragged out, and they went clattering down the street on parade, and people stood and gaped and admired the fine uniforms. To me, they always looked like an army corps in retreat, something shabby, bedraggled, crestfallen about them, their uniforms too big for their bodies, all the alertness which as individuals they possessed to such a remarkable degree, gone now. When the sun came out, however, things looked different. There was a ray of hope in their eyes. They walked more elastically. They showed a little enthusiasm. Then the color of things peeped out graciously, and there was that fuss and bustle so characteristic of the French. At the bistro on the corner, they chattered gaily over their drinks, and the officers seemed more human, more French, I might say. When the sun comes out, any spot in Paris can look beautiful. And if there is a bistro with an awning rolled down, a few tables on the sidewalk, and colored drinks in the glasses, then people look altogether human. And they are human. The finest people in the world when the sun shines. So intelligent, so indolent, so carefree. It's a crime to herd such a people into barracks, to put them through exercises, to grade them into privates and sergeants and colonels and whatnot. As I say, things were rolling along smoothly. Now and then Carl came along with a job for me, travel articles which he hated to do himself. They only paid 50 francs apiece, but they were easy to do, because I had only to consult the back issues and revamp the old articles. People only read these things when they were sitting on a toilet or killing time in a waiting room. The principal thing was to keep the adjectives well furbished. The rest was a matter of dates and statistics. If it was an important article, the head of the department signed it himself. He was a half-wit who couldn't speak any language well, but who knew how to find fault. If he found a paragraph that seemed to him well written, he would say, "Now that's the way I want you to write. That's beautiful. You have my permission to use it in your book." These beautiful paragraphs we sometimes lifted from the encyclopedia or an old guidebook. Some of them Carl did put into his book. They had a surrealistic character. Then one evening, after I had been out for a walk, I open the door and a woman springs out of the bedroom. "So you're the writer," she exclaims at once, and she looks at my beard as if to corroborate her impression. "What a horrid beard," she says. "I think you people must be crazy around here." Fillmore is trailing after her with a blanket in his hand. "She's a princess," he says, smacking his lips as if he had just tasted some rare caviar. The two of them were dressed for the street. I couldn't understand what they were doing with the bedclothes. And then it occurred to me immediately that Fillmore must have dragged her into the bedroom to show her his laundry bag. He always did that with a new woman, especially if she was a Française. "No ticky, no shirty," that's what was stitched on the laundry bag, and somehow Fillmore had an obsession for explaining this motto to every female who arrived. But this name was not a Française. He made that clear to me at once. She was Russian. And a princess, no less. He was bubbling over with excitement, like a child that has just found a new toy. "She speaks 5 languages, he said, obviously overwhelmed by such an accomplishment. "Non, 4, she corrected promptly. "Well, 4 then. Anyway, she's a damned intelligent girl. You ought to hear her speak." The princess was nervous. She kept scratching her thigh and rubbing her nose. "Why does he want to make his bed now?" she asked me abruptly. "Does he think he will get me that way? He's a big child. He behaves disgracefully. I took him to a Russian restaurant, and he danced like a nigger." She wiggled her bottom to illustrate. "And he talks too much, too loud. He talks nonsense." She swished about the room, examining the paintings and the books, keeping her chin well up all the time, but scratching herself intermittently. Now and then she wheeled around like a battleship and delivered a broadside. Fillmore kept following her about with a bottle in one hand and a glass in the other. "Stop following me like that," she exclaimed. "And haven't you anything to drink but this? Can't you get a bottle of champagne?" "I must have some champagne. My nerves. My nerves." Fillmore tries to whisper a few words in my ear.
An actress, a movie star. Some guy jilted her and she can't get over it. I'm going to get her cockeyed.